This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back from vacation. Thanks to Marty Moss Cohen for filling in for me. Tomorrow there are presidential primaries or caucuses in seven states. David Duke won't be on the ballot in any of them. The former Ku Klux Klan leader, who was constantly in the headlines just a few months ago during the Louisiana gubernatorial election, is now in the news mostly for being shunned by the Republican Party. The Republican Party in Georgia kept Duke off their ballot, calling him a fringe candidate whose political views are contrary to those of the party. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court denied Duke's appeal to appear on that ballot. My guest Hadding Carter points out that each time Duke seems to be politically dead, he soon undergoes a resurrection. Carter investigates the career of David Duke in a documentary that will be shown tomorrow night on public TV as part of the Frontline series. Hadding Carter grew up in Mississippi, where he began his career reporting for the newspaper run by his father. The newspaper was known for its editorial support of the civil rights movement. Carter eventually ran the paper and later became State Department spokesperson under Jimmy Carter. He's since become known for his TV commentaries on politics and the media. I asked Hadding Carter what he thinks of the Republican Party's efforts in several states to keep David Duke off the ballot.
It is in a fine old dishonorable American tradition, which is to try to force all insurgencies off the ballot and to retain the ballot only for the Orthodox. I wish I could say that this was peculiar to the Republicans. It's not. Frankly, it's a mistake. The parties ought not to be playing the exclusion game. They ought to be out there taking on this kind of insurgency head on and making of it what they can.
So what ballots does he have left? Where will he actually be on the ballot now?
You know, at this point, I'm not even sure. I think he has something like five of the southern states coming up that he will be on. He will be in enough places to accomplish what is one of his main objectives, if he can do it at all. That is to get even one delegate so that he can appear at that convention as the choice of someone who will try to nominate him. He wants the vehicle of an appearance at the National Convention. That, of course, scares the absolute devil out of Republican strategists.
I think a question that your Frontline investigation tries to get to the bottom of is, has David Duke changed as his rhetoric has changed, or is the rhetoric just a cover for the same Ku Klux Klan and Nazi ideals that he once openly espoused?
I think that's the basic point of this documentary, is to try to answer the question not how is David Duke going to do politically, but who is this David Duke who wants to do things politically? Has he changed? He has been changing his external forms consistently ever since he was a young man. He takes off a robe and puts on a swastika, takes off the swastika and the robe and puts on an organizational label called, not as cute as he thinks it is, but cute enough, the National Association for the Advancement of White People. He then, in that guise, puts forward what is patently inoffensive notion that we have a right to organize just the same as anyone else, and behind that guise, of course, distributes virulently racist and anti-Semitic material. He then says, well, actually, that's not really me anymore, though it's still in my house. Who I am is who you see. The public figure who ran and got elected by my people in my legislative district in Louisiana. I'm now speaking for middle-class and working-class Americans. That's me. Then now, he says, and now, of course, I'm a man running for president, speaking for the forgotten American. But the fact is that David has a bad habit of talking privately, trusting privately, making himself open privately to folk who retain not merely their notes, but their tapes. And in those tapes emerges the private David Duke. And we are obviously playing some of those tapes on this show.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Hadding Carter, and he has a new investigation called Who is David Duke? That's going to be broadcast tomorrow evening as part of the public television Frontline series. David Duke has really used television to get ahead, and he's really, in a lot of ways, mastered the art of being a talk show guest and someone with good sound bites and an image that always changes to suit the times. Do you think that television is the best medium for you as a reporter to use to try to reveal who Duke really is?
I think that television is an absolutely necessary medium, but not the only one to reveal it, because it is necessary to take the person who has become a master of this medium and then to turn it around and to contrast that which he does off stage, off camera, with that public image. One of the problems is, of course, we are rapidly building a 5 billion person media savvy world in which everybody knows how to play the game on camera, knows how to smile and smile and smile and play still be the villain, as it were. And if you don't catch them up with the same medium, the result is the mastery of what is, in the end, a morally neutral form of communication. I've watched him a lot of times on live shows, have watched the results, and they are often devastating because the medium is disinclined repeatedly to go as in the face with a liar as a liar is to lie. There's a level beyond which it is bad television and considered apparently bad form by interviewers to keep coming back to the person and saying, but excuse me, that is a lie. It is necessary, it seems to me, to take this form and demonstrate the lie.
Now, David Duke didn't give you an interview for your Frontline program, but his sister did. What's their relationship like?
Well, apparently it's a lot better than it used to be. She has been appalled over time by his public behavior and his private beliefs. She feels, and I really sympathize and respect the feeling, that her brother has become a changed person. She definitely wants to believe that. She expresses the belief that he has found a Christian faith that makes him no longer the hater that he was. She does not have a lot of contact with him. She is both physically separated and long ago emotionally separated from the family, but she definitely thinks that he is a changed person.
What are your personal reasons for wanting to investigate David Duke and reveal who he really is?
David Duke taps into something which is not a Southern phenomenon, but a national one. There is a large group of people in this country, white people in this country, working white people in this country, who have not only a sense of grievance against the society, but in fact are victims in this society. They are looking for reasons for their economic and social position and the problems that they face. David Duke offers them the easy answers. David Duke capitalizes on the fact that these folks are essentially outside the process and are ignored by almost everybody in it. David Duke takes people, therefore, who are already victims and twice victimizes it. If you want to get right down to it, I want, to the extent that I can, and this is pretentious as hell, but it's a fact, to the extent that I can, to say to these folks, look, find another messenger. This guy is going to betray you because in the end, he's not talking about your interest. He's talking about his own, and it's a different and a hidden agenda. I talked to some folks just sitting around in a bar. It's your typical sort of set-up bar thing. Well, at the end of it, I came away thinking, this is absolutely unfair. These guys are already really screwed over by this society, and they're sitting here believing that this is their salvation, and this salvation is going to do it to them again. It is the oldest pattern in the South. It's also one of the oldest in the nation, the abuse of the abused by the demagogue. And I hope to this extent that this documentary could at least make some small contribution in separating them away from him.
Have you had any personal encounters with Duke over the years?
You know what? I think I've been in the same room or place with him maybe three times in this entire period of time. While he was a boy over at LSU, I was running a newspaper in Mississippi. When he was developing himself as a very public Ku Klux Klansman, I was just beginning to take off to go off and work for Jimmy Carter in another type of Southerner, quite different from David Duke. So I only watched him out of the corner of my eye. I sort of hoped that what he was doing was representing the dead end of some of the worst of the Southern traditions. One of the reasons, again, that I'm interested in this piece is that I don't want to see that dead end suddenly open up onto the main highway again.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Hadding Carter, and he's the reporter on a new documentary called Who is David Duke that will air tomorrow evening on public television as part of the Frontline series. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Hadding Carter is my guest. You grew up in Mississippi. You were born in New Orleans. Your father, when you were growing up, ran a newspaper in Mississippi. What did the Klan mean to you when you were growing up?
The Klan always meant the enemy. The Klan, it was a very interesting thing. My great-great-uncle rode with Nathan Bedford Forrest, and after the war, a Confederate general, rode with him again, at least in family legend, when he created the Klan. I say that to tell you that there was some falling away from that family tradition by the time it got to my dad, who saw the Klan as being the personification of almost all that had been destructive and sick in his native South. In our section of Mississippi, the Klan had been beaten back in the 1920s, in large part because of the effort of a very famous family, the Percy family. Later, one of the Percy brothers of the next generation, Walker Percy, the novelist, who received a great deal of national attention. But the Percys had confronted and beaten back the Klan in my area of Mississippi by the time I came along. Then, in the civil rights days of the 1960s, the Klan reemerges. That is, the sublimated disease comes out again in response to the pressure and reemerges in the most vicious form since Reconstruction. Killers, arsonists, terrorists. And at that point, the Klan represented to me, I was then running the paper by then in the 1960s, the Klan represented to me a direct physical threat to me since I was on their hit list, and a direct threat to what seemed to me to be the most glorious opportunity we in the South had had since Reconstruction to remake ourselves as a more decent society.
Were there crosses ever burned on your lawn?
Sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, I still got a piece of one that was burned on my lawn, and my wife still has intact somewhere one that was burned on hers. We weren't married then. She was in Jackson, Mississippi, and quite visibly engaged in civil rights activity. But I want to say something really carefully here. I'm white. I was a person running not a large institution by absolute terms, but within that community, a newspaper. I was the last logical victim in reality for the Klan, which is, after all, run by cowards. People did get hurt. People did get killed, but they weren't white newspaper editors in Mississippi. They were mostly black folks and some stray civil rights folks who weren't black and the like. But, you know, what the group that educated David Duke in the wonders of white supremacy, the Citizens Councils, had a boycott against our newspaper from 1955 until 1969, and a fairly successful one in the outlying areas around the town that I lived in. And I never had much fondness for them either.
Let me ask you, when the Klan is burning a cross on your lawn and you're in the house as it's happening, what do you do?
Luckily, I'll tell you a story. At the time of the integration of Ole Miss in 1962, which ultimately required federal troops to enforce and the death of two people, I had written an editorial the morning that it occurred saying that the governor of the state had committed sedition and should be in the federal penitentiary. We promptly lost 10% of our circulation. And that night, it became pretty clear from the threats coming into the paper that bad things were going to happen. And so an off-duty deputy sheriff who was a friend and a restaurant owner who was a friend and I lay outside the house, which was out in the country, with guns all night waiting for these people to come. My wife fixing coffee and not quite reloading the guns, but you know that idea. And nobody came. Nobody came. And my dad and my brother and my uncle and my mother came driving up from New Orleans, where they were all living, to save and defend their son and brother and nephew, the case might be. And they all arrived about 5 in the morning, and of course nothing had happened. And went in, wrote the editorial about how we have to bind up the wounds and all of that, with the smoke still rising over the university campus. And we were exhausted. And we fell into bed and were all asleep by 9 o'clock, and then they came and burned the goddamn cross while we were fast asleep. And the thing that is wonderful about that, of course, is that we would have killed them. And what's even more wonderful about the fact that we didn't is that 3 days later, the sheriff, who was the only political sheriff who was ever a friend of ours, found out who they were. And they were 3 teenage kids. And we would have blown them away. We were terrified, of course. And we're lying out there with shotguns and pistols and all of that. I carried a gun for the first 6 years I was back in Mississippi, both macho business and ex-Marine and terror all combined, and put it away somewhere in the middle 60s, thank God, and never, you know, picked it up again. But it was a time that encouraged that sort of reaction.
What makes you so sure you would have killed them had you been awake?
Because we were sitting there on hair trigger. We were there scared, and we were lying right there at the entrance to the house where they burned the cross. Well, I say killed them. I mean, hell, we would have shot. You know, it was that's the nature of that sort of thing. It's what's particularly dangerous about the gun.
Yeah.
Is that it is there to be used, and when the moment comes that it may be used, you're in the clutch of an emotion which encourages you to use it quickly and think about it second.
Did you ever use it, the gun?
Never. Never. As I say, I used to carry one in my belt and in my car for a long time, and luckily nothing ever occurred that required me to use it. And what did happen, and the real reason I put the gun away, was that one of my brothers killed himself with a pistol, and that's pretty much encouraged me to believe that no good except grief would ever come out of a gun.
Was it suicide or accident?
Well, it was an accident which occurred at a time, and he was playing idiot games with a pistol. So, you know, what do you call it?
Right.
But he was a college student at the time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Haydn Carter, and he has a documentary on David Duke that airs tomorrow night on Frontline on public television. You know, in talking about David Duke, you think that Duke has a new rhetoric, but that his beliefs haven't fundamentally changed. Have you ever met somebody who you knew or knew of when they were in the Klan who you believe really has changed?
Yes, actually, I have. It's a strange thing. There was a guy who was a killer. He went to the pen. He was involved in a very famous incident in Meridian, Mississippi, in which the FBI, in effect, entrapped him and his girlfriend as they were coming to kill a Jewish leader in Meridian, killed the girlfriend, wounded him, and pretty well put him away for a while in the pen. And somewhere in that period, he had what he believed to be a major religious experience, and considered himself to be born again. And by every indication, ever since he's been out till this moment, has been out there living and preaching an approach which is totally different. Now, I cannot read into the depths of a person's soul, but I can certainly tell a difference in the way people behave on a consistent basis, and he has. But he's not unique. I mean, I initially carried long memories about people's position, whether they had been Klansmen in the 20s and I'd heard the family stories, or whether they had been major Citizens Council figures during the days of the organization of that segregationist group. And for a long time, I wasn't willing to accept the fact that people could change. And then it became very obvious to me that they had, and they were, that they simply had reappraised what it was that they had been thinking, and in the light of what they now saw had fallen away. Also, let me say something about most people. Most of us find it easier to go with the tide than to swim against it. But when the tide changes, a lot of people feel mighty liberated about not having to be going in that particular direction. And folk can, in fact, free themselves from old mindsets.
That's an interesting point. Can I ask you if there's any one thing that you're finding particularly interesting about this presidential campaign? Any one thing that's particularly surprising you?
No, what surprised me and disheartened me and indicated the near fatal condition of the Democratic Party is a list which begins with the word Rockefeller, moves through Bradley, Cuomo, Gore, Nunn, and moves on from there. Of all those who were, in fact, people who were seen as being first-tier figures who didn't run out of pure gutlessness or out of some sense that their better day would come another day, and that what we now have are, in fact, some fairly able guys, but not what you'd call household names, out there fighting for the nomination. I was surprised by the failure of so many of these other folks to get in. The other thing I'm interested in is that, in its own halting way, the Democratic primary is finally going about the business of, in effect, declaring victory and trying to get on with redefining the Democratic Party. By declaring victory, meaning actually the New Deal, Fair Deal, Great Society programs, even under Reagan, are now sort of permanent warp and woof, so let's quit talking about that stuff and let's talk about some of the problems that confront us in the future, not least of them being how do we make this economic engine work again. I'm surprised that that has come out as fast as it has, and that's irretrievable, I would add. That's going to be part of the debate from now on.
Do you ever want to run for office?
Did I ever want to run for office is the question to which I would answer yes. Do I want to now? The answer is no. Dreams of glory probably still awaken me in the middle of the night, but they don't consume my daytime. They don't consume my daytime thinking.
Hodding Carter, his documentary about David Duke airs tomorrow night on the PBS series Frontline. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.